welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. John Cozy is back today. John is a retired philosophy professor. Oh, I say it all the time, but it's worth repeating. He's now writing on social, political, and economic issues. John likes to pick topics that particularly strike him at any point in time. He's got a new article he sent me a few days ago. We're going to talk about it this morning. It really touched a nerve in me, and I sent John an email saying he reflected back 2 days gone by. We're both about of the same generation, and it really made me reflect back to think how different things were then than they are now. They were far from perfect, absolutely not perfect, but compared to today, it seems like paradise in so many ways. Anyway, we'll get to that in a moment. I just want to say one more thing about something I simply can't get out of my thoughts and mind and gut and my heart and my soul, and that's just another word or two about Hugo Chavez. He died on the 5th of March. I began writing about him on the 6th. After I got through with about half a dozen articles, I said, I can't imagine what else I have to say. I wrote another article this morning. I put out a new article this morning I wrote yesterday. I called it Chavez Laid to Rest. There's a lot in it. I hope listeners will read it. A lot was on my mind. I expressed it in the article. James Petras, who was on Friday, wrote an absolutely marvelous article calling Chavez a 21st century Renaissance man. I quoted from his article. His article was the best I've read on Chavez. Detailed, very comprehensive, so much in it that needed to be said. I felt I wanted to quote him and also get my own thoughts in. This morning I noticed a scurrilous Washington Post anti-Bolivarian propaganda editorial. Well, you know, over the years they've done so many, not just the Post. I took on the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago. I've taken on the New York Times many times. I've taken on other members of the U.S. scoundrel media. I'm sure that some of them know me very well by now. Well, the Washington Post can expect my response to its scurrilous editorial tomorrow. And I title it, Washington Post, Anti-Bolivarian Propaganda. That's exactly what it is. The title of the editorial is, Free Speech Under Fire in Latin America. Well, America, the America I live in, the United States, we should have the kind of free speech that so much of Latin America has, especially Venezuela. I'll say one thing and then jump to John. Venezuela is the most open society in the hemisphere, without question. Chavez insisted on it. It's mandated in the Constitution. There were laws that were passed, the National Assembly, its parliament, that affirmed free expression, free press, so on and so forth. And to say otherwise is a bald-faced lie. Anyway, read my article. I'll put it out tomorrow, and you'll get the truth. John, your article that you call The Tragedy of Being Human, a Mean Spirit, you really touched a nerve for me. I'll let you talk about it.
Oh, let me just say, Steve, that, you know, it's not a great article. I just happened to notice that it's impossible to get away from the meanness that's evident in our society today. I mean, no matter where you look, you know, people are being mean to each other, mean to their children. Children being mean to their parents, entertainment with dialogue in it where, you know, performers are mean to each other, Congress making speeches, you know, where they're mean to each other. A new pope gets elected and immediately he's attacked. Mean-spirited attack. Yeah, sure, he may have, you know, not done everything he could have done during the dictatorship in Venezuela, but you know, none of us do everything we can do with it, and so what, you know, but whenever anything happens, the first thing that happens in this country is the mean spirits come out and start slinging at each other.
Well, there's a lot of meanness around, there's no question. What touched me was really comparing today with what was the situation years ago, decades ago, when we were much younger than now. And that's what really strikes me, because I think about that often, and I've mentioned it at times in some of the articles that I've written. I don't dwell on it too much, but when it's appropriate, I brought it up. And there really are some stark differences, including the education system, where people like you and I could go to college and graduate school and get an education for a very modest cost compared to the way it is today. You could come out debt-free. I came out of graduate school owing a couple of hundred bucks, which even in the $1960 dollars really was nothing but pocket change that I easily paid off in my first year without even trying. It was so simple. But the kids today, of course, anybody who goes to college, not anybody unless you're rich, but so many of the kids come out dead and trapped. They can spend many years, and some of them could spend a lifetime and remain dead and trapped, and there's no way to get out of it. Well, it wasn't that way long ago when you or I were back then, and so many other examples are the same way. It was a different world back then, even though it was far from perfect. There was meanness then too, John. I remember homophobia. And racism and the whole bunch of it.
Yeah, you know, one of the points that I made in the article is, you know, the example I gave of the community in which I lived, in which I grew up in, was that this is not, you know, a paradigm for the country as a whole. It was just one little place. But you can't find even little places like that anymore. I mean, there aren't, and that little community, as I pointed out, had no policeman, had no jail, had no lawyers. Nobody was ever robbed. Nobody was ever assaulted in the years I was there. No homes were ever broken into. No woman was ever raped. No kid was ever bullied in school.
John, you mentioned you grew up in semi-rural Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And nobody needed to lock their doors. Nobody was worried about anybody breaking it.
I don't even think the house that I lived in had keys to the lock. To the doors. I don't ever remember seeing any keys to those doors. You know, I mean, and of course that community was not American. I mean, you wouldn't have found that community anywhere in Mississippi. You would not have. You wouldn't have found it in South Carolina. I'm not sure you would have found it in Virginia. That was a community mostly of immigrants, Eastern European immigrants.
John, in 1968, I moved with my family to San Diego. I was involved. This was in relation to our small family business. And we rented a home, and I remember the landlady telling us, people just don't lock their doors around here.
Yeah.
And my wife and I were absolutely aghast. Absolutely aghast. People don't lock their doors. We moved from Pittsburgh, from the city, close to the University of Pennsylvania, where my wife was teaching. And people certainly lock their doors in Pittsburgh. They don't in San Diego. We simply couldn't fathom a comment like that. But it was true. And once we settled in, we didn't worry about anybody breaking in and harming us in any way.
It was just a different world. And the sad part about it is, of course, you know, that human beings claim to be able to learn from the past, but they can't. They don't learn from their past. Nobody under the age of 60 has any idea of what that world was like. Nobody. You know, I mean, and so, you know, when I write that stuff, I get comments from people, you know, wondering, you know, what kind of fairy tale world I'm writing about. And it's not because they think I'm It's because they just haven't had anything like that in their experience. They don't know what happened before they were born. And that's what's going on. Of course, that's one of the reasons I write about it. It's time that they found out what happened before they were born.
Oh, it really is time, John, and we're both old enough to remember. I certainly remember when Lyndon Johnson, who was a first-class scoundrel in so many ways, but I still remember him declaring war on poverty. Declaring war on poverty. Today, there's a different war on poverty being declared and being waged. It's making it worse, not better, and Johnson didn't do enough to get rid of poverty, but at least he wanted to do something. At the same time, America was at war that it never should have been in the Vietnam War. This was in the 1960s. But we actually had a president who thought that maybe we ought to do something to alleviate poverty, and the notion today is absolutely nonsensical in the minds of people who run the country. They want to force-feed austerity to make it worse for everybody, including the most impoverished.
Now it's completely different. I happen now to live in one of those rabid right states, where the legislature just passed anti-abortion, 12-week anti-abortion law or whatever. I said to some people that are talking about it, he doesn't care about these unborn kids that he's claiming to talk about. Whose lives he's claiming to protect. I said a person who doesn't care about living kids certainly doesn't care about unborn kids. And he doesn't give a hoot about the living kids in this state that are hungry at night, go to school, without having had breakfast or maybe even slept for that matter. I don't know, the homeless. He doesn't care about any of that. And you say, well, why does he claim to care about these unborn kids? It's easy. He doesn't have to spend any money on unborn kids. But boy, if he takes out, to do something for the ones that are already alive, it's going to cost him a bundle. And that's all there is about it. It's not about life or, abortion or medical practice or religious belief or anything else. It's a damn stingy legislator who doesn't want to pay any money to help anybody. That's all there is to it.
And it's also hypocrisy, John.
Well, yeah, it's hypocrisy, but... what politician isn't hypocritical?
Well, that's right. It goes with the territory. But
yeah.
They rail against abortion, especially the right-wingers. And at the same time, they appropriate hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars to go around the world murdering people.
Yeah.
If that isn't hypocrisy, what is?
The whole damn thing's hypocritical. They say they want a balanced budget. They don't want a balanced budget. If they had a balanced budget, their bankers couldn't make any money. Who the hell are they kidding? Bankers make money by lending to governments. That was the whole idea to begin with.
I thought they made money by stealing it, John.
Well, that same thing, but. But if the United States balanced its budget, our bankers would go broke.
Some of the little ones go broke, but the big ones are simply licensed to steal as much as they want for as long as they want. It's so easy to do, John. They control
for
the
sure.
U.S. Treasury. They control the Federal Reserve. If you and I had the printing press that they have, my goodness. Just think what we could do, John.
Yeah, sure. But my point is, these people who claim we have to get on a sound fiscal footing and balance our budget are lying. There's no hope of ever, doing that. Those people have no hope of doing it because their bankers would go crazy if they didn't have the ability to lend to the federal government or to any government for that matter. You can't have a balanced budget in this country and have the financial scheme that runs it. The whole thing is absurd. As a matter of fact, to get back to my paper, I claim that the whole problem behind all the meanness in America is the mean economic system. Now, I've been arguing this for years. Nobody pays attention to me. People don't learn their morals, their ways of acting, by being taught by their parents at home about right and wrong, or by attending Sunday school classes or whatever, or even in school. I mean, you could hang the Ten Commandments on every wall in every schoolroom in the country and not change a darn thing. People learn their morals from watching how they're treated by other people. And what they learn in America is that the commercial classes lie, cheat, and steal. And, of course, that's what they're going to do. They're going to lie, cheat, and steal. I mean, these people who talk about, individual freedom and all of that and economic freedom. Economic freedom is nothing but a license to steal, unregulated license to steal. I said to somebody one day, I said, what do you think would happen if we, deregulated burglary?
Well, that's an interesting thought. I never thought about that.
Yeah, deregulate burglary. Oh, you'll have a lot of burglary. Yeah, and you deregulate banking. Well, you have a lot of stealing. I mean, it's not. I hate this expression because rocket science isn't very difficult, but it's not rocket science. Good. Deregulate burglary. Good. Ron Paul wants libertarian system. Go ahead and do it and see what happens.
Yeah. It wouldn't work the way the extreme practitioners wanted to.
I don't understand it. But nobody. We have a whole class of economists in this country. People I really despise. I've despised them since my first economic class in college, where the guy was so damn dumb. I didn't know how he managed to get his shoes on in the morning. But people don't realize that burglary is an economic activity. It's just like selling jewelry in a jewelry store. I mean, you're in it for the money. But no economic laws that the economists talk about. There are no economic models about burglary. That's not part of the science. Well, what would physics be like if we said falling bodies weren't part of physics? We didn't, pay any attention to what falling bodies do because that's not part of physics. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's absurd.
Yeah, it really is, John. It really is. But it's amazing. I occasionally write about what I call the big lie. And the bigger the lie, the more often it's repeated, the more likely it is to be believed. And I guess it goes without saying because it seems to be the case all the time. And people are a lot smarter. Practitioners are the ones who make comments like that. Joseph Goebbels. There's a well-known quote that I've used occasionally, haven't for a while, but he basically said exactly that. You keep repeating the little lies, they pass under the radar. People don't even notice them. But the big ones, if you repeat them often enough, you can get the great majority of people to believe this stuff. I think Hermann Goering said just about the same thing, and others have said the same thing. It's true.
Yeah, there's nothing new about this.
No, there's nothing new at all.
This morning, my wife turns the TV on the minute she gets out of bed. Nobody watches it half the time, but it goes. And this morning, she had ABC Meet the Press on. And, this commentator... was on. He had Ron, and he had Ryan on. Okay, and Ryan was repeating his old stuff over and over and over again. Okay, It was allowed. I said, you know, and I said to myself, you know, that's a neat little trick. I mean, you have these politicians come on your show from different points of view, but there's one point of view that's always absent, and that's truth. You know, nobody ever is there, you know, providing the truth. It's just what this party believes and what that party believes. But they repeat the same stuff over and over and over and over and over, as though there were nothing different to be said. And, of course, the people don't know any different. They just believe it. They hear it over and over and over again. And, it's just so ridiculous that it's hard to stomach, but that's what's going on.
Pretty awful, some of the stuff that goes on, John, and unfortunately too many people don't take the trouble to find out, separate the truth from the chaff, and it's why America gets away with murder, and it certainly gets away with a lot of it repeatedly.
Oh, it's not that it gets away with it. I mean, it's what we do. I mean, it's not as though, you know, America is something else that is engaged in murder on the side. I mean, that's not the way it is. America is murder if it does anything else. That's what's on the side. I don't know as much about. I read James Petras' piece this morning. I knew a fair amount about Hugo Chavez, but I never really tried very hard to learn, you know, a lot about him. But he's obvious, you know, that he was cut from different cloth than politicians here, at least in North America. And I don't know, in many places, perhaps in South America too. But yeah, and the ways that Americans have been vilifying him, especially on the news, is, or what's called the news in America, is shameful. I mean, he has done more for the people of that country in his short tenure than anyone else has in history. But of course, we don't gonna report that stuff. He didn't make enough money for bankers, you know, especially American bankers. I'm pretty unhappy with what I've seen going on here recently in America. The news channels have been hyping this series on the History Channel on the Bible. I never heard, you know, the news channels in this country hyping anything on the History Channel. Why are they all of a sudden hyping this, you know, this series on the Bible? What the heck can you show on TV about the Bible except Bible stories? You can't come up with any, you know, sophisticated intellectual analysis of any of it. You show stories. Why? Why are they so hopped up about this now, about the Bible? And I say to myself, well, I don't know, especially the History Channel, which isn't very popular. Why are they popularizing this? And I say to myself, well, why did Hollywood make a movie about the rescuing a few people from Iran on the Iran crisis? And why did Hollywood make a movie about the assassination of bin Laden? You know, why is Hollywood going to make a movie about, Noah's Ark? You know, I mean, what's all this all about? I'll tell you what it's about, guys. It's jingoism. We've got a war going on between Judeo-Christianity and Islam. You'll hear more of it.
John, I wrote about Hollywood's historical revisionism. I talked about the Bin Laden movie, Zero Dark 30, CIA agents involved, you know, lionizing CIA agents and the rest of them. I may be getting my movies mixed up, I'm not sure, but Argo, the Academy Award winner, that's the one I really featured. It was a pathetic propaganda piece that ignored the entire significance of the 1979 revolution. It completely distorted what happened. It took a side incident that literally didn't matter compared to the major thing that went on. And this is typical Hollywood rubbish. And
jingoism.
Oh, jingoism is right. I mean, America has wanted to overthrow the Iranian Revolution since it happened.
And that gets me back to the point I was making a little while ago. You know, the Iranian government that was overthrown because it wanted Mossadegh, his government, it was overthrown because of his desire to nationalize the oil industry, happened before most Americans living today were born.
Oh, absolutely, 1953.
And they don't have a slightest idea that anything went on in Iran before the Iran hostage crisis. You know, and the hostage crisis was against us, so the Iranians must be bad people by that. We're not going to tell them that we went in there and overthrew their democratically elected government and stuck a dictator in office. We're not going to tell them that. That happened before. We're only going to tell the American people the part that we want them now. That's all.
Yep.
It's so tiresome. I'm glad I'm an old man, I guess.
Well, I mean, anybody who watches Hollywood movies or television, you know, the new stuff that comes out, the old stuff that shows up on TV, the made-for-television broadcast, including the History Channel, John, there's no way in the world you can understand what the devil is going on, let alone why, who's behind all this stuff, and who profits, who loses, the rest of it. I mean, it's all propaganda rubbish. And then when movies like Argo win an Academy Award, what it's getting is an Academy Award for propaganda. That's what
right?
It is.
Sure. So, you know, ask yourself, you know, I mean, I don't know why I'm, I don't know, you know, why this is a struggle. Well, I guess I do know why. I mean, I just like the lies of it all. I mean, these so-called supposed liberal actors communities in Hollywood and everywhere else, you know, a number of years ago, I was having a cigarette break. I smoked back then, don't know, with some people from the company. We were outside. It was a pleasant day in here talking about actors. And I said, you know, I don't know why people pay attention to actors. They never do anything. And the person looked at me, what? They never do anything? I didn't know. All you ever do is pretend. You know, and then that's what Hollywood is. It's a big pretense. And it dumbfounds me that we care about these people. It really does. I mean, what in the hell? Look what happens, you know, when Arnold Schwarzenegger had to quit pretending because he thought he knew everything because of his pretense and got to be governor. You see what really happened, don't you? The same thing with Ronald Reagan. When you don't have a script to read, it's a lot tougher.
Oh, it really is. Well, Ronald Reagan knew how to read his script, not very well, but he knew how to find his mark, and he knew how to read his lines. Didn't do too well, but you know, I mean, he was a trained actor, so he did it better than some others. Well,
yeah.
Schwarzenegger, I never paid much attention to Schwarzenegger. Well, he was governor of California like Reagan. Reagan, I mean, you couldn't turn on your TV set without running into Reagan. If you live in California, I guess it would be that way about Schwarzenegger. Anyway, short break.
There's the music. Here's the fat lady.
We'll be right back. back on with John Cozy. Another great discussion with John. John, I love the way we can pick up on a theme that you write about and then expand on it to discuss related issues. And they're really so important, and you never hear this stuff in the mainstream. I think very often, even in the alternative media, you don't hear enough of this. People need to reflect on these things that really are very important. They can get very deep. You're a philosophy professor, so you can consider it from that point of view. But it comes right down to plain ordinary things that affect us in our daily lives. Let me let you continue with more of what you want to say.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, the establishment is the same generation after generation after generation. And we can point out the jingoism that's going on, you know, in Hollywood today, and the hypocrisy of the whole system. But of course, it went on. It went on in 1910, 15, the era before the First World War. It went on before the Second World War. It went on in the Cold War. It's going on today. It's the same old stuff. I mean, you know, I once wrote a paper that I've somehow or other lost. I mean, I can't find it anywhere. In relation to a meeting of some sort that was held at college that I taught at, and it was about freedom of the press, and it was when the Russians, when the USSR, excuse me, there weren't any Russians there. We're in power. Was the USSR was in power, and it was our arch enemy. The American press was railing against the fact that the USSR had two governmental provided news agencies, TASS and Pravda, whatever. And that because they were governmental agencies, they could not be trusted. And everybody took that for granted, as though that was the way things were. And in contrast, because American news media were private enterprises, that they somehow or other could be trusted. And I laughed at that. When one of our political science professors presented that, you know, I burst out laughing. I said, "Look," I said, "maybe, you know, TASS and Pravda don't tell the truth when something that affects the government, you know, is being reported. Maybe so, but everything that TASS and Pravda reports doesn't affect the government. And when it doesn't affect the government, TASS and Pravda don't have any reason not to tell the truth. You know, to just tell it." I said, "Let's take an American newspaper, okay? We have two, three, four different news agencies, whatever, reporting on some non-governmental event. You know, how do you know any of them are telling the truth? They're in it for the money. They want readers or listeners or viewers today, but they don't have any reason to tell the truth at all. They depend on their livelihood. They depend on readers for their livelihood. And if they can titillate readers by telling, you know, falsehoods about events, they're going to tell falsehoods about events. It's, why are you trusting the private media that do things for money and not trust a governmentally paid agency that has no axes to grind when dealing with some event that's not governmentally related?" And you know, I shook up that audience. They were aghast. But people don't think simple things, just simple things. They don't ask questions about America. People in America don't realize that the Spanish-American War was caused by a newspaper.
William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah, a newspaper caused the Spanish-American War. Yeah.
There's a famous quote that goes back from there, and Hearst told his reporter down in that region, his words were roughly, I may not have them exactly right, but his words were, over a century ago, of course, his words were, you give me the pictures, and I'll give you the war.
Yeah, precisely. You know, I mean, that they didn't give a hoot about people getting killed. They didn't give a hoot about right or wrong. All they cared about was selling papers. And, you know, I was, you know, I mean, you go on TV today, every TV channel, including the news channels, are in it for the same reason. They don't give a hoot about the truth. They don't give a hoot about whether or not people are going to get killed. They don't give a hoot about the suffering. All they care about is Nielsen ratings. You know, let's face it, people. You can't trust anybody selling anything. And in America, the news is sold just like popcorn in the movie theater.
Oh, so true. So true, John. Absolutely. Just another commodity. Another commodity. Way, way back when, oh my God, decades ago, news used to be a separate operation. It was at least in part separated from the profit-making side of the television networks when there were only three of them, ABC, CBS, NBC, no cable channels, none of that stuff. And news at least had a separate place. It was far from perfect, but you know, we went on CBS, for example, we went from Cronkite to Couric.
Yeah.
I mean, we actually had a legitimate newsman, Walter Cronkite, and we went to this show woman who absolutely knew nothing about anything going on at home or abroad, and they made her a news anchor. That shows the travesty of the U.S. media when it comes to reporting the news and information. They simply don't do it.
Yeah, and the same is true about Hollywood. You know, there used to be a thing called acting that was an art form. There's no acting anymore. How many actors do you know who haven't done anything but play the same role over and over and over and over again, just in different circumstances?
Oh, it's true. I mean, they have
they can't act. There's one actor in Hollywood, Meryl Streep. She's the only actor in Hollywood. There is nobody else. And it shows, you know. She gets her Oscars year after year after year after year, and somebody else gets one and nominated for another 10 years later. Oh boy, she's a good actress. She's won an Oscar. What are you talking about? You know, I mean, I don't know why you got me wound up here, Stephen.
Let me throw in another comment about Walter Cronkite. He was long retired from his anchoring. I once tried to get him on this program. It was too late. He was in his 90s. He passed away a few years ago. He was in his 90s. I reached his office. He kept an office. CBS let him have an office in downtown Manhattan as long as he was alive. And I spoke to someone in his office, a woman. I'm not certain what she did for him, but she was in his office, and she explained to me that he's now in his 90s. He decided that really he doesn't want to do this anymore. He just wants to relax. He wants to go out in his boat. He wants to take life easy for whatever time he has left. I couldn't blame him, John. I mean, after all those years, give the guy a break. That's what he wanted to do. I never tried to contact him again, but it would have been wonderful if I could have had him on once before he died. I didn't get to do it. He's long gone now, so I won't get a chance.
Yeah, you know, you remind me, that brings back memories to me. My father, who never spoke very good English. My father was a very bright man, taught himself to read English, and he never went to school, taught himself to read Russian, taught himself to read English, okay? But he couldn't speak very good English, but he always watched Walter Cronkite. He couldn't say Cronkite. He used to say Cronkike. every day at clock. I'll never forget it.
Well, I remember him well. Absolutely remember him well. And compared to what exists now, what a difference. And he actually reported some things that people needed to know about the Vietnam War that's impossible today about America's wars going on. Whatever is most important absolutely is 100% suppressed.
Yeah, he didn't report opinions. He did not.
So he reported some facts, and Lyndon Johnson accused him of causing America to lose the Vietnam War. well, he told some truths.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he never reported opinions. He never told you what his opinion was. And he shouldn't. I mean, he did the right thing. He shouldn't have.
Not as a newscaster. On an opinion show, you state opinions. But on a newscast, you're supposed to report the news.
I don't know why Americans have all this love for opinions. People say everybody has a right to his own opinion. I said, no, he doesn't. What do you mean? If everybody had a right to his own opinions, everybody would have a right to be wrong. Nobody has a right to be wrong.
Well,
but you know, I mean, it's true. You can't stop people from having opinions. I mean, that's one thing, but you can't claim that they have a right to them. It's just the kind of stupid misuse of language that people in journalism at least should know about. I mean, that's supposed to be a linguistic activity. You can't say you have a right to have an opinion.
Responsible opinions, John, should be backed up with some facts.
Well, yeah, you can have. People can have opinions, and they can have reasons for holding the opinions. But to say that they have opinions is different from saying they have a right to opinion. They don't have a right to opinion.
Well, there's nothing in the Constitution that says we have a right to an opinion.
We have a right to express things
that we wish to talk about. But I don't think the word opinion appears in the Constitution.
No, nowhere. Neither does the word capitalism.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. So true.
So,
a lot is left out of the Constitution, John. There really is nothing much magnificent about a Constitution that says a lot of things. There's clarity in places. There's ambiguity in other places. The Constitution has literally been twisted over the years, so politicians can use it any way they want to use it, and it can be twisted by the president to make the president a virtual dictator anytime he. There hasn't been a she so far, so I'll stick with he. But when there is a she, when a he or a she would be in power to be able to use it, and the Congress does absolutely nothing to stop the president.
I just hope I live long enough to vote for the first it.
For the first it? Well, I talk about the system is so dysfunctional, John, that if Mickey Mouse were the person sitting in the White House, it simply wouldn't make any difference from the way things are now.
It wouldn't make a bit of difference, and you know that's one of the things that's so hilarious about. What's going on and all this, like the president wants this and the president wants that. It's baloney. The president doesn't want anything. The establishment tells the president what to do, just like it tells Congress.
Oh, absolutely. I call it the power structure, John, the embedded power structure. The system. The system is embedded, and it doesn't matter. The names and faces change, but the system stays the same. It's hardline. It's extremist. It has a policy of permanent wars. Neoliberalism is the policy now. I mean, this is the way it is, and nobody gets to the Oval Office unless they're willing to go along with all of this, lock, stock, and barrel, the whole lot of it, and that's the system. So, I mean, I rail against Obama all the time. I railed against George Bush the same way, and yet I understand they were chosen to be the public face of the system. Well, my feeling is if their morals disagree with what they're supposed to enforce in the position that they hold, they never should have taken the job. But my God, if anybody had a chance to get it, who would pass up such an opportunity? You get rich, you get power, everybody knows who you are, they can love or hate you, but you're set for life.
Yep. I mean, I've often wondered, How does a person like George W. Bush live the rest of his life knowing what the world's historians are going to say about him forevermore?
I don't know how he lives without knowing what he did, John. I mean, the blood on his hands and the blood on Obama's hands, and these people call themselves, I guess, good Christians, whatever they call themselves. They show up in church on Sundays every now and then. Well, I don't know if they do it because they want to do it. They do it, I guess, because it looks good. They want people to think that they're religious people and they care. But how can they live with themselves? How do they sleep at night knowing that their policies, the ones that they instituted, caused so much harm to so many people? And, you know, I mean, the wars abroad, the immense harm that's done to ordinary people at home. I mean, this is what their policies do. I couldn't live with myself knowing I did that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wonder about it. Yeah, apparently it doesn't bother them a bit, you know, and it's kind of ridiculous. You know, have we stopped doing it? No, we just keep, we even double down on it. And I say to myself, you know, what's with these people? I was corresponding with the person who wrote to me about one of my pieces, and I said, look, consider this analogy. Suppose you had in your potable water system in your house a leak that was, you know, flooding a room or a floor or whatever. I said, would you tell all the people you know, your kids and your wife, all, grab a glass and go drink water? Or would you go get the leak fixed?
Well, I think you would get the leak fixed.
Yeah, but you see, that's not what we do with our foreign policy.
Oh, that's for sure.
We're not fixing the leak. We're telling people to drink more water.
Indeed, we spring new leaks too, John.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, so what do? You lose the war. Well, you can't win the war in Korea. That's number one. You lose the war in Vietnam, okay? You lose the war in Iraq. You lose the war in Afghanistan. So what do? You prepare to go to war against Iran and North Korea and God knows who else in Africa.
Great.
What do we love this losing wars? I mean, is that the goal, American goal in the world, to lose wars?
America hasn't won a war since World War II.
Oh,
literally.
You forgot about the Hollywood War in Grenada.
Oh, yes, I do remember Grenada, Reagan's first overseas.
The Hollywood War.
The Hollywood War. The Chicago Police Department could have handled it as easily as the Marines.
Boy Scouts could have handled it.
The Boy Scouts, indeed. To rescue medical students from that horrible liberal leader on the island, oh, my goodness, over 30 years ago now, I think, Reagan's first foray into militarism. And I do remember it well.
Yeah, but you know, I don't understand this. You know, if you're pushing a policy that goes wrong once, and goes wrong twice, goes wrong three times, doesn't it ever occur to somebody that perhaps you need to change the policy? You know, where everybody's, you know, shaking in their boots about North Korea's missile launchers and successful atomic tests, and they're shaking in their boots, and we're going to put $1 billion of interceptor missiles in Alaska and I don't know where else. You know, I say to myself, wouldn't it be easier just to make friends?
North Korea, John, has wanted normalized relations with Washington for at least the last 30
Everybody
years.
Everybody does. They don't want this kind of stuff going on.
That's we'll right.
Push them into it. But wouldn't I just ask myself, what's the matter with these people? Don't they know enough to say, hey, maybe we just ought to make friends?
That's not good for the war profiteers, John. The war profiteers need enemies.
Well, I know it's no good for the war profiteers. No good for the funeral directors either.
That's right. Well, I don't know. I don't know how. Well, if, the U.S. bodies, but now they use drones, so there aren't too many U.S. bodies from the wars. Okay. Troops still in Afghanistan. That some body bags come home, but not big numbers like Vietnam. And they're slowly moving more and more over to drone war. So you'll have somebody sitting in monitoring computer terminals and keyboards many miles from a war theater, and it's bloodless for them.
There's something that nobody seems to take into consideration. Every one of these areas where we're using, where we're having drone wars, are in places where nobody has the facility to fight back.
Well, that's exactly right. In the replacement,
what's going to happen to all of these drones and drone wars? If, say, for instance, the Pakistani Air Force decides they shoot them all down.
Well, that would be quite a surprise if they try to do something like that.
Yeah, what would you do? You couldn't stop them.
Oh, you couldn't stop them.
Can't stop them.
No, you couldn't stop them.
You know, and you say to yourself, well, the Pakistanis are always claiming that they don't approve of these drone strikes. They don't do anything about them. Of course, we know why they don't do anything about it. They're pocketing the American money faster than it comes in.
Well, they sure are. And you have to separate the rhetoric from the policy,
yeah,
John. They say
yeah.
one thing and they do another.
Yeah, that's just bribery. That's all. But what's going to happen? I mean, what's going to happen if you try to use them in Iran, where they have an air force that'll shoot them down?
Oh, they could shoot them down, and they have downed U.S. drones.
They've
downed them, and they've downed them without damaging them, and they've re-engineered them to find out just how these things work, so you could replicate them and have an Iranian drone that can match the U.S. drone. Now, that would be an interesting drone war, wouldn't it, John?
Yeah.
Drone versus drone. We're certainly doing a number on Iran, and I'm very concerned about the possibility that there could be a war launched against Iran. It would be absolute madness if something like this happened. Israel apparently wants it. We'll discuss it on this program. I think there are high-level people in both countries who understand it is absolutely an act of madness to go to war with Iran. I can only hope that they will hold sway over the crazies in both countries, Netanyahu and his government. His government will be sworn in on Monday. Obama arrives Wednesday. There'll be 3 days of absolute nothing, spending a lot of money. I saw a little blurb that 15,000 Israeli police officers will protect Obama while he's in country, accomplishing absolutely zero, plus Israel's Secret Service and the rest of it. You know, the money that goes into transporting a president and protecting him on the ground, I mean, it's literally millions of dollars flushed right down the toilet.
Yeah. But then again, electing a president does the same thing.
Yeah,
millions of dollars if we flushed down the toilet in the last election.
Oh, indeed, John. You hear that music striking
up. Oh, there she is singing again.
Oh, well, I look forward to getting you back next month to continue this. And whenever you send me an article, I always look forward to it. That's the way I discovered you in the first place. I read one of your articles before I knew anything about you, and I said, I really want to get John on my program as a guest. I never regretted it. I look forward to getting you back all the time. I wish you well, John. I'll send you an email off air, and I'll remind listeners to tune in every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time.
Yeah, tell them to go to Global Research and read my piece.
On your blog site.
Well, on my blog site, too, but you know, it's probably easier to find on Global Research.
Oh, indeed it is.
Because when we talk about these pieces, I never really want to get into the details of talking about them.
I understand. John, I got to go.
Yeah, okay. Bye-bye.
Weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.